Part two. The threshold question before us is whether the executive has the authority to detain citizens who qualify as enemy combatants. There is some debate as to the proper scope of this term, and the government has never provided any court with the full criteria that it uses in classifying individuals as such. It is made clear, however, that for purposes of this case, the enemy combatant that it is seeking to detain is an individual who it alleges was part of or supporting forces hostile to the United States or coalition partners in Afghanistan and who engaged in an armed conflict against the United States there. We therefore answer only the narrow question before us whether the detention of citizens falling within that definition is authorized. The government maintains that no explicit congressional authorization is required because the executive possesses plenary authority to detain pursuant to Article 2 of the Constitution. We do not reach the question whether Article 2 provides such authority, however, because we agree with the government's alternative position that Congress has in fact authorized Hamdi's detention through the AUMF. Our analysis on that point set forth below substantially overlaps with our analysis of Hamdi's principal argument for the illegality of his detention. He posits that his detention is forbidden by 18 U.S. Code Section 4001A. Section 4001A states that no citizen shall be imprisoned or otherwise detained by the United States except pursuant to an act of Congress. Congress passed 4001A in 1971 as part of a bill to repeal the Emergency Detention Act of 1950, which provided procedures for executive detention during times of emergency of individuals deemed likely to engage in espionage or sabotage. Congress was particularly concerned about the possibility that the act could be used to reprise the Japanese internment camps of World War II. The concentration camp implications of the legislation render it abhorrent. The government again presses two alternative positions. First, it argues that Section 4001A, in light of its legislative history and its location in Title 18, applies only to the control of civilian prisons and related detentions, not to military detentions. Second, it maintains that Section 4001A is satisfied because Hamdi is being detained pursuant to an act of Congress, the AUMF. Again, because we conclude that the government's second assertion is correct, we do not address the first. In other words, for the reasons that follow, we conclude that the AUMF is explicit congressional authorization for the detention of individuals in the narrow category we describe, assuming without deciding that such authorization is required, and that the AUMF satisfied Section 4001A's requirement that a detention be pursuant to an act of Congress, assuming without deciding that Section 4001A applies to military detentions. The AUMF authorizes the President to use all necessary and appropriate force against nations, organizations, or persons associated with the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. There can be no doubt that individuals who fought against the United States in Afghanistan as part of the Taliban, an organization known to have supported the Al-Qaeda terrorist network responsible for those attacks, are individuals Congress sought to target in passing the AUMF. We conclude that detention of individuals falling into the limited category we are considering for the duration of the particular conflict in which they were captured is so fundamental and accepted an incident to war as to be an exercise of the necessary and appropriate force Congress has authorized the President to use. The capture and detention of lawful combatants and the capture, detention, and trial of unlawful combatants by universal agreement and practice are important incidents of war. The purpose of detention is to prevent captured individuals from returning to the field of battle and taking up arms once again. Captivity in war is neither revenge nor punishment, but solely protective custody, the only purpose of which is to prevent the prisoners of war from further participation in the war. The time is long past when no quarter was the rule on the battlefield. It is now recognized that captivity is neither a punishment nor an act of vengeance, but merely a temporary detention which is devoid of all penal character. A prisoner of war is no convict. His imprisonment is a simple war measure. The object of capture is to prevent the captured individual from serving the enemy. He is disarmed and from then on must be removed as completely as practicable from the front, treated humanely, and in time exchanged, repatriated, or otherwise released. There is no bar to this nation's holding one of its own citizens as an enemy combatant. In Quirin, one of the detainees, Haupt, alleged that he was a naturalized United States citizen. We held that the citizens who associate themselves with the military arm of the enemy government and with its aid, guidance, and direction enter this country bent on hostile acts are enemy belligerents within the meaning of the law of war. While Haupt was tried for violations of the law of war, nothing in Quirin suggests that his citizenship would have precluded his mere detention for the duration of the relevant hostilities. Nor can we see any reason for drawing such a line here. A citizen no less than an alien can be part of or supporting forces hostile to the United States or coalition partners and engaged in an armed conflict against the United States. Such a citizen, if released, would pose the same threat of returning to the front during the ongoing conflict. In light of these principles, it is of no moment that the AOMF does not use specific language of detention. Because detention to prevent a combatant's return to the battlefield is a fundamental incident of waging war, in permitting the use of necessary and appropriate force, Congress has clearly and unmistakably authorized detention in the narrow circumstances considered here. Hamdi objects, nevertheless, that Congress has not authorized the indefinite detention to which he is now subject. The government responds that the detention of enemy combatants during World War II was just as indefinite while that war was being fought. We take Hamdi's objection to be not to the lack of certainty regarding the date on which the conflict will end, but to the substantial prospect of perpetual detention. We recognize that the national security underpinnings of the war on terror, although crucially important, are broad and malleable. As the government concedes, given its unconventional nature, the current conflict is unlikely to end with a formal ceasefire agreement. The prospect Hamdi raises is therefore not far-fetched. If the government does not consider this unconventional war won for two generations, and if it maintains during that time that Hamdi might, if released, rejoin forces fighting against the United States, then the position it has taken throughout the litigation in this case suggests that Hamdi's detention could last for the rest of his life. It is a clearly established principle of the law of war that detention may last no longer than active hostilities. Prisoners of war can be detained during the armed conflict, but the detaining country must release and repatriate them without delay after the cessation of active hostilities, unless they are being lawfully prosecuted or have been lawfully convicted of crimes and are serving sentences. Hamdi contends that the AOMF does not authorize indefinite or perpetual detention. Certainly, we agree that indefinite detention for the purpose of interrogation is not authorized. Further, we understand Congress's grant of authority for the use of necessary and appropriate force to include the authority to detain for the duration of the relevant conflict, and our understanding is based on longstanding law of war principles. If the practical circumstances of a given conflict are entirely unlike those of the conflicts that informed the development of the law of war, that understanding may unravel. But that is not the situation we face as of this date. Active combat operations against Taliban fighters apparently are ongoing in Afghanistan. The United States may detain, for the duration of these hostilities, individuals legitimately determined to be Taliban combatants who engaged in an armed conflict against the United States. If the record establishes that United States troops are still involved in active combat in Afghanistan, those detentions are part of the exercise of necessary and appropriate force and therefore are authorized by the AUMF. Ex-party Milligan does not undermine our holding about the government's authority to seize enemy combatants as we define that term today. In that 1866 case, the court made repeated reference to the fact that its inquiry into whether the military tribunal had jurisdiction to try and punish Milligan turned in large part on the fact that Milligan was not a prisoner of war, but a resident of Indiana arrested while at home. That fact was central to its conclusion. Had Milligan been captured while he was assisting Confederate soldiers by carrying a rifle against Union troops on a Confederate battlefield, the holding of the court might well have been different. The court's repeated explanations that Milligan was not a prisoner of war suggest that had these different circumstances been present, he could have been detained under military authority for the duration of the conflict, whether or not he was a citizen. Moreover, as Justice Scalia acknowledges, the court in ex parte querend dismissed the language of Milligan that the petitioners had suggested prevented them from being subject to the military process. Clear in this rejection was a disavowal of the New York State cases cited in Milligan on which Justice Scalia relies. Both Smith v. Shaw and McConnell v. Hampton were civil suits for false imprisonment. Even accepting that these cases once could have been viewed as standing for the sweeping proposition for which Justice Scalia cites them, that the military does not have authority to try an American citizen accused of spying against his country in wartime, Quirin makes undeniably clear that this is not the law today. Haupt, like the citizens in Smith and McConnell, was accused of being a spy. The court in Quirin found him subject to trial and punishment by a military tribunal for those acts, and held that his citizenship did not change this result. Quirin was a unanimous opinion. It both postdates and clarifies Milligan, providing us with the most apposite precedent that we have on the question of whether citizens may be detained in such circumstances. Brushing aside such precedent, particularly when doing so gives rise to a host of new questions never dealt with by this court, is unjustified and unwise. To the extent that Justice Scalia accepts the precedential value of Quirin, he argues that it cannot guide our inquiry here because in Quirin it was uncontested that the petitioners were members of enemy forces, while Hamdi challenges his classification as an enemy combatant. But it is unclear why, in the paradigm outlined by Justice Scalia, such a concession should have any relevance. Justice Scalia envisions a system in which the only options are congressional suspension of the writ of habeas corpus or prosecution for treason or some other crime. He does not explain how his historical analysis supports the addition of a third option, detention under some other process after concession of enemy combatant status, or why a concession should carry any different effect than proof of enemy combatant status in a proceeding that comports with due process. To be clear, our opinion only finds legislative authority to detain under the AUMF once it is sufficiently clear that the individual is in fact an enemy combatant. Whether this is established by concession or by some other process that verifies this fact with sufficient certainty seems beside the point. Further, Justice Scalia largely ignores the context of this case, a United States citizen captured in a foreign combat zone. Justice Scalia refers to only one case involving this factual scenario, a case in which a United States citizen POW, a member of the Italian Army, from World War II, was seized on a battlefield in Sicily and then held in the United States. The court in that case held that the military detention of that United States citizen was unlawful. Justice Scalia's treatment of that case in a footnote suffers from the same defect as does his treatment of Quirin. Because Justice Scalia finds the fact of battlefield capture irrelevant, his distinction based on the fact that the petitioner conceded enemy combatant status is beside the point. Justice Scalia can point to no case or other authority for the proposition that those captured on a foreign battlefield, whether detained there or in a U.S. territory, cannot be detained outside the criminal process. Moreover, Justice Scalia presumably would come to a different result if Hamdi had been kept in Afghanistan or even Guantanamo Bay. This creates a perverse incentive. Military authorities faced with the stark choice of submitting to the full-blown criminal process or releasing a suspected enemy combatant captured on the battlefield will simply keep citizen detainees abroad. Indeed, the government transferred Hamdi from Guantanamo Bay to the United States Naval Brig only after it learned that he might be an American citizen. It is not at all clear why that should make a determinative constitutional difference.